Welcome back to Tales of Southwest Michigan's Past. This is Michael Delaware. I am your host. Today, we're going to return for another look at one of the oldest institutions established in the state of Michigan, not long after the 1837 statehood. And that is the Michigan State Prison, founded in Jackson, Michigan. So joining me today again is Judy Gale Krasnow. She is the author of a book on the history of the prison called Jacktown, History and Hard Times at Michigan's First State Prison. Today we're going to explore some more of the fascinating stories in her book and learn a little bit more about the forgotten history of Jackson, Michigan. So welcome back to the show, Judy. Thank you for taking time to be on the podcast today.
I am very happy to be back here again and talking about one of my major passions, the history of Michigan's first state prison.
Well, I was glad to have you back on. So, Judy, could we begin by reintroducing yourself to the audience for those who maybe missed the first interview you did? How did you get on the path of writing this book about the state prison?
Well, to start with, I am a professional storyteller. I've been a performance artist doing stories and folk songs since I was a child, actually. But then I moved to Miami, Florida, and lived there for 26 years, and things got really hard after three hurricanes in 4 months.
Wow.
And I thought, it is time for me to leave Miami. And driving to a performance one day, I flicked on National Public Radio, and exactly at that moment, a program from WDET Detroit came on talking about an old penitentiary in a place called Jackson, Michigan, that was being renovated into a resident artist community for arts of all kinds.
Wow.
It had me fascinated. 2 weeks later, I was here as they were tearing out the old cells, and my guide gave me little bits and snatches of the history, and I thought, a storyteller's dream, because I also focused on historical stories and impersonations of or women who made a difference. And I thought, this is a treasure house.
Wow.
And I upped and moved from my townhouse in Miami to an old prison. And the town actually wanted to focus on the arts and change its prison image. But everyone was so fascinated by the building and the grounds, and the old prison wall, and the old guard towers.
Yeah.
They'd ask questions, and I had been reading, and researching, and my answering questions turned into a tour business.
Wow.
Of the historic prison. And as that went on, the History Press and Arcadia asked me to write a book.
Oh, so they reached out to you. That's cool.
They reached out to me, and I also had written two books that had been published, one on storytelling and one on my father, who was the producer of the original Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer song.
Oh, wow.
And Frosty the Snowman. So I thought, wow, this is a change.
Yeah.
Sure, I'll write the book. And I did.
That's great. You know, that also, I love that story because it tells you also about the power of radio during that time period. I mean, I remember the days when all you had to listen to in your car was radio, you know, and you heard a lot of news from around the world. It's so different today because everybody has all this self-programming ability with everything from, well, podcasts and programming your own music and whatever, but and the radio has kind of gone into a decline. But back then, that was a major source for gathering news around the country. And look what it brought you to this amazing journey you've been on.
This was almost 20 years ago that program was on. Mm-hmm. And it was meant to be, because the moment I pushed the button from WDET in Detroit,
wow,
it came. So, and I have absolutely no regrets. It has been a fascinating journey. Mm-hmm. And I will just say that the people that I have met through my research, through the tours, I've met wardens, former prisoners, psychologists, prison psychologists, mm-hmm, families of prisoners, both descendants of ones who were, mm-hmm, in the old prison, and people who have had families today. And it is such a learning experience about human beings and existence and behavior and treatment and punishment and crime. It's just been fascinating.
Wow. So the book is called Jacktown, and it's the history and hard times of Michigan's first state prison. It's been out for a while, but when we talked about your book the last time, we didn't go into one of the more entertaining stories of the book, which was the one about Hannibal the Bear. Can we talk a little bit about his story and how that came to be, and put us in some kind of the time period and the context of when this all went down?
Absolutely. Hannibal the Bear was the name for a man, a logger in Kent County, whose name was Edgar Hannibal.
Okay.
Edgar Hannibal was well over 6 feet tall. He was 350 pounds plus. He was apparently really hairy, I mean, covered head to toe. And he did his logging, but today, if we were to study him, mm-hmm, I think he would be classified as autistic, maybe with Asperger's syndrome, mm-hmm, because he couldn't understand people saying something or joking with him. To him was an insult. He couldn't stand being touched because he'd hear voices from the touch. So what happened with Edgar Hannibal is he was a great logger. Mm-hmm. But one day, another logger who had it in for Hannibal picked up an axe and threw the axe at Hannibal, who managed to dodge it before it lodged in his shoulder. But then in his reaction and rage and fear, he picked up the axe that had dropped to the ground, mm-hmm, and held it up high. And the other man was walking toward him, and there was a whole commotion. And the officers on the grounds came, and what they saw was Edgar Hannibal standing there with an axe in his hand, no questions asked. He was taken to Michigan's first state prison, where when the inmates and the guards saw him, they called him Hannibal the Bear because he looked like a bear. He was that hairy and big. And his voice, by the way, also was a very growling voice. And he ended up in prison. And there, too, anybody that said something that he comprehended in his particular way, he would pick up his hands were apparently huge and also covered with hair. And he'd pick up that hairy big hand, sock them in the jaw, and inevitably broke every jaw he socked.
Wow.
So he ended up spending, out of the total, ultimately, of 8 years in prison, about four of them, they calculated, were actually spent in solitary confinement as punishment.
Oh, I see.
However,
because he would engage with these other prisoners that way and injure them, huh?
Yeah. Oh. And it wasn't so much out of malice as I read about him. He totally misunderstood what people said to him. Uh-huh. However, his guardian angel, shall I call him, was the night keeper. They weren't called guards, they were called keepers.
Right.
And this was the head keeper of the night shift, John H. Purvis,
okay,
who was also quite a reformer. But he claimed to be able to read the hearts of the inmates. And he saw that Hannibal had a good heart, and he believed Hannibal had been thrown into the woods to be raised by the wolves, which was why he had absolutely no idea of normal social interaction.
Interesting. Interesting observation that he made.
Yes. And he wrote stories about Hannibal. And I don't know, time-wise, and I love talking about Hannibal, so if you have to hurry me up or stop me, do so.
No, go on. This is fascinating. So what? So there's this engagement that changes Hannibal's life a little bit with John Purvis coming into basically being his keeper at night.
Right. Now, Purvis had to enforce punishments.
Mm-hmm.
If an inmate did break a rule. However, he treated Hannibal, I think, with pretty much the only kindness that Hannibal experienced in his life.
Okay.
And this story, when I would tell it, we'd be down in the old prison, in the old solitary area.
Wow.
And people would, literally, tears would come to their eyes, and I would, till I got used to telling it, I would find myself choking up. Hannibal had a major enemy in the prison, not of his choosing, but another logger, John Nichols, Silver Jack Nichols,
okay,
who himself was a rather violent person, but I mention Silver Jack because of the story I'm about to tell. In a day and age when men did not knit, Hannibal the Bear, as he was named in the prison, somehow got a pair of wooden knitting needles.
Okay.
And skeins of wool. And he taught himself to knit. And he sat there breaking the code of silence, saying, knit one, curl two, knit one. And John Purvis would have to say, Hannibal, there's a federal law of silence. No talking, no whispering, no whistling. Quiet. But Christmas Eve came, and John Purvis was on duty. And when he walked by Hannibal's cell, Hannibal said, Mr. Purvis, I know I'm not supposed to talk. You're supposed to talk first, and then if you want me to answer, I can answer. But, Mr. Purvis, I have a Christmas gift for you. So John Purvis went over and said, oh, how sweet of you. Thank you very much. And he handed him, Hannibal, handed Purvis something wrapped in, like, papers found in the garbage, pasted together for wrapping paper. And John Purvis said, well, thank you very much, and I'll put this under the tree. No, no, Mr. Purvis, I want you to open it now. I want to see you when you open it. So John Purvis opened the gift. And it was a beautiful, perfectly knit one pearl two scarf.
Wow.
That Hannibal had made for the Night Keeper. And it drew tears from Purvis. And he said, oh my gosh, we keepers are not supposed to show emotion. And here I am all choked up and crying. But then he looked in the cell and he saw little droplets of water dropping down onto the floor of Hannibal's cell where Hannibal was standing.
Wow.
And Hannibal's tears were that big that they dropped like raindrops to the floor, that he was able to see John Purvis and be thanked in person for this gift that he made from the heart that John Purvis had read quite correctly with Hannibal, a good heart.
Wow. That is an amazing story. And that came from some of Purvis's writings and then some of your other research that you did when you were putting the stories together for the book.
And,
wow.
Right. And I had mentioned Silver Jack Nichols because Silver Jack Nichols had caught Hannibal knitting. And at one point, he went up and he stuck his hands through the bars of the cell and pulled the skeins of wool and dropped them all over down, you know, the stairs and everything, and then got all the inmates to laugh at Hannibal because he was knitting. But it did not deter Hannibal. He so respected John Purvis and what Purvis meant to him and how he was treated by him that he went on anyway.
Wow.
And by the way, Silver Jack was put in solitary by Purvis for having, and Purvis had no idea what the wool was for, but for having done that with something that belonged to another inmate and was being used. So,
wow.
Yeah, the stories are, you know, just amazing. And ones like that counteract the literally medieval punishments that in the 1800s were part and parcel of penitentiaries all over the country and right here in Michigan.
Okay, so let's move on to another story. So when we talked about your book the last time, there were some stories of escapes that I don't think that we got to that there's one that you specified in the book that was an escape that became quite bungled, as you might say. Can we talk a little bit about that one, the one that became kind of a funny tale in the end?
Well, the ones that, you know, I really recall and did write about are, let me begin by saying that the way they could escape from this fortress, I mean, we're talking brick and sandstone and iron and so forth. Apparently, the building was not maintained. So by 1919, and before that actually, but by 1919, absolute, it was condemned, and they had to start building another state prison, which is still standing up on Cooper Street, but and still in use, by the way.
Okay.
But what happened is boards in the wall and bricks and the stones were all coming loose. And the way the prisoners escaped was they pushed them out. They didn't have to take big shovels and dig and dig.
Oh.
They actually you know, knock pieces of the building out and then squeeze through. The other thing that made escapes not easy, because the guards were always looking, but more possible than not, is they took chips of soap and would stick them in the locks in various places. Uh-huh. So the locks would kind of get greased, and if they, you know, jiggled and turned, would open.
Oh.
But the escapes that got bungled were most of them, because the prisoners would hitchhike, mm-hmm. and get someplace, but even the hitchhikers knew quickly after they picked them up what they were transporting.
Oh,
but
I see.
Before I go there, I'll say there was one where the fellow came out, but he couldn't get over the wall. The wall, by the way, initially was the prison wall, mm-hmm. 14 feet high.
Okay.
And somehow prisoners could stick their fingers and hands in the crevices and get 14 feet high fairly quickly before they were seen, you know, by a guard, or even if seen, jump over 14 feet.
Wow.
So they eventually, when there were several escapes that weren't bungled, they added 11 more feet to the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And today, as it still stands, it's 25 feet high. But this one man who got out very, very cleverly timed it so that he wouldn't be seen, mm-hmm. timed it so that none of the prisoners would snitch on him and all. But then his longing was to lie in the sun and breathe fresh air and hear the birds.
Okay.
So his longing was so great that he lay down in the bushes that thickly bordered the prison wall,
mm-hmm.
and thought, I can't be seen here, but I'm lying amongst branches and birds and bugs even, mm-hmm. and everything. And he fell asleep. And of course, they were looking for him, and they found him. So he had had his, you know, wonderful sun bath out in the air, but he had bungled his escape by, in his joy, falling asleep.
Wow!
And then there is one more that I would love to tell.
Sure.
Because I first heard it, believe it or not, from the bus driver that would take us. The tours did this building, and before, the Ella Sharp Museum took seven block over as a prison museum. We used to do the second half of the tour there and tell stories.
Mm-hmm.
And the schools loaned their buses and drivers to us to take the people, because people weren't allowed back then to just drive, mm-hmm. onto the premise of the old prison. And our bus driver had grown up in a farmhouse across from what is now, you know, the Michigan State Prison on Cooper Street. And there were escapes, but the people would always come and hide in the haystacks and so forth and be found. She told me this story, and I then found it recorded, not verbally, but, you know, written down, and it's in my book. But this prisoner worked in the coal mines. You know, they had coal mines in this area, and the inmates were the cheap labor coal miners.
Okay.
And one of the major machines that was used in the coal mining had broken. So one of the prisoners said, well, I've been working in the mechanics shop. I've been working in the mines. I'll fix it. So they let him go fix it. And they figured he couldn't get out because all the doors were locked. So he took some soap and put them in one door. And there was a rug in front of the door. And he said, oh, to the keeper, this rug is filthy. While I'm here, I'm going to clean it. Do you have a rug beater? And they brought him one.
Wow.
So after he fixed the coal mining machine, he beat the rug and did it super loud so they would hear and know he was busy working. But then what he did is with the soap chips in the lock on the door, open the door, take the rug, take off his prison garb, and wrap the rug around him and run out. And he ran across to a farmhouse, knocked on the door, and said that he had been robbed and that they had taken not only his car but his clothing, and he had found this rug in a garbage can along the route of his trying to get to civilization. And the people, he was such a con artist that they took him in. They let him shower, which was a dream come true.
Wow.
Because they could only, you know, wash like twice a month and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then the husband, the farmer, gave him clothing, his own, wear my socks, my shoes, they were about the same size.
Wow.
And so, but he was about to leave and hitchhike as a normal farmer when there was a knock on the door. And the, you know, prison figured that he had made an escape. So he didn't get any further.
Well, at least he got a shower out of it, you know.
Yeah, right.
Wow. Well, in the earlier interview, we also talked about a lot of the troubled times of a very difficult warden, but there was also a reformer or a couple of reformers in the prison that we didn't have time to get to. There was a reformer by the name of Hatch that came into the system around 1885 in your book. Can we talk about him a little bit?
Right. Sure. H.F. Hatch. They never used his name, so I've looked it up, but I can't find it. He just comes up as H.F. Hatch.
Okay.
And he firmly believed that the human mind needs activity. It thinks, it has questions that we people want to know things. And he felt that the repetition of the jobs that these men had for their 33 and a half cents a day in the factories that were within the prison walls on the prison grounds were tedious, repetitive, taught them nothing, and the code of silence, they weren't even allowed to talk.
Right.
And that humans with our ability to speak needed communication. So he set up a school in the prison, and every inmate had to go. It was a requirement, and they would go to school for the length of time as though they were in a school out of prison. And the interesting thing is the highest education, the person who had the highest education in this old prison had no more than fifth grade.
Wow.
So he took, he had people who hadn't gone beyond kindergarten here, and he said, that's one of the causes of crime. when your head isn't filled and you're not communicating and sharing mm-hmm. positive thoughts and positive growth, the mind tends to disintegrate to negative things.
Makes sense.
So, every single prisoner, and they had a graduation after the fifth grade, and he also believed that when people committed a crime, no matter what their temperament, they felt low about themselves, and they felt low being imprisoned, mm-hmm. and that the education could help them find ways to feel good about themselves. And it was a highly successful, needless to say, program. And the other advantage of it was when they went out, they could get employment because right. they could read. Some of them were illiterate, yeah. and he had those who could read help them write. There was like a buddy system mm-hmm. of the ones that could do math, help those who had trouble with it, and so forth. So they all felt like they were useful.
Yeah.
And, you know, his feeling was that if you feel useful, it brings out the good in a person.
Yeah.
So he, and even when he was no longer warden, that continued. But he was here starting 1885, and John Purvis was still here.
Okay.
Through, I believe it was 92. So these two got together, and they formed, like, discussion groups mm-hmm. and anything that could be a feed-off of the education classes. So at that time in the late 1800s, we had two really caring, ardent reformers in the prison. Mm-hmm. And it made a huge difference in terms of the fights that would go on among inmates, the attempts at escapes.
Right.
And so H.F. Hatch, and they continued. His schools so proved the reason that he established them, that in the other prisons in the country, they also followed suit.
Wow. And that was all the late 1800s that Purvis and Hatch were there?
Right. And so, then, okay. And I mentioned this man in my book because I find it really interesting that Michigan's first state prison, this old prison where I now live, mm-hmm. was such a leader in reform.
Yeah. I was amazed about that when I read your book that, you know, they went through some very dark times where it was very, very much of a torture place, but there was also this bright ending to that reform period with Hatch and Purvis, you know, bringing some humanity to the rehabilitation of these men, which was, it was good to see that you could see the direction changing, you know.
Right. And it continued on in 1933, and it actually started 1931. The chaplain, Albert M. Ewart, was a jack of all arts. He wrote music. He wrote, you know, essays. Mm-hmm. He painted. He worked in clay. He was quite amazing. And I was fortunate enough when his granddaughter heard that this lady from Florida mm-hmm. was moving here and that I was a storyteller.
Yeah.
She got a hold of me while I was still in Florida and said, "You've got to tell my grandfather's story. It's amazing. And when I visited, she took me to her house, mm-hmm. and she had trunk loads of his memorabilia and his paintings and all. He, when he became chaplain, felt that the arts, being creative, was in addition to the schooling, something that really would help when they got out of prison, help them rehabilitate if they never got out. And he taught art classes and writing and music.
So let's move on to another topic. There was a story about the wagon manufacturing that I wanted to try to get into. You mentioned that the prisoners had to do manufacturing, and one of them was wagon making, that the wagon company was attached to the prison at one time.
Yes, and they made, at that point, you know, wagons like the wagons that took people westward.
Right.
And the Jackson wagon was the leading wagon purchase that carried the people west in the gold rush.
Wow.
It was, what was it, Allen Tomlinson and the owners. Mm-hmm. But the other thing about the Jackson wagon is people at that point were experimenting and dreaming of automobiles, like Studebaker mm-hmm. was a company and so forth. So the prisoners who made the Jackson wagon, they were the laborers.
Right.
They figured out a way to put a lever in that if you pushed it forward, the wagon would move on its own at 3 miles an hour.
Interesting.
And if you pulled the lever toward you, you know, back, it worked as a brake.
Oh, cool.
So they made those, and Jackson became known as one of the earliest leaders in automobile manufacturing.
Wow.
Because the Jackson wagon could go with the lever manipulated 3 miles an hour on its own.
Interesting.
So the initial factory was within the prison walls, and they discovered after the fact that it burned down, terrible fire. Mm-hmm. And they discovered it was lit by an arsonist. So, you know, he was caught and duly punished. Mm-hmm. But they then built the wagon company where Art 634, which is across the parking lot from the old West Wing, Art 634 became the Jackson Wagon Company after the fire.
Oh, okay. So that's the building. Okay.
That's the building. It has quite a history. Mm-hmm. And again, the pioneers loved the wagon. It was comfortable. It was, you know, roomy. It got them to the gold rush.
Yeah. So, and wasn't there a story where they actually made a wagon that was larger for the circus so it could carry an elephant or something like that?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Jumbo.
Oh, that it made Jumbo's wagon. Wow.
Yes. He could not. He was getting old. Mm-hmm. And he couldn't walk the full length of circus parades anymore. Mm-hmm. And people clamored to the circus. They loved that elephant. Mm-hmm. So, you know, P.T. Barnum, they approached the Jackson Wagon Company. Mm-hmm. You know, is it possible for you to make a wagon big enough and sturdy enough to hold an elephant weighing what this elephant weighs, a couple of tons.
Oh, it's probably about 10,000 pounds at least, yeah.
Yeah. So the Jackson Wagon Company made the circus wagon that was sturdy enough, was big enough, and that became the wagon that wherever the circus went and they had their parade, that Jumbo was taken around in.
Wow.
So, I mean, the thing to me, and I get all excited about this, is here was this medieval penitentiary, but the stories, human beings and inmates and guards and whoever, you know, just what grows out of life, these amazing stories. Yeah. It's just, you can imagine, I spent hours and days and weeks at the archives of the Michigan Historical Museum in Lansing.
Okay.
And, you know, reading whatever I could find and whatever books had been written. Albert M. Ewer, his daughter, had essays and stories that the inmates had written for their writing classes.
Right.
And it just, I mean, as I said, a storyteller's dream come true.
Yeah. Wow. That is quite a story. That is, so we are doing an event together on April 6th, and you mentioned Art, Art 634, and that's the venue that we're going to be holding the event. It's called the Michigan True Crime Symposium, and we're doing the event with a couple of other true crime authors. I've talked to Tom Carr on this show, and Tobin Book just did a interview with me last week. And so they're kind of excited about doing this program together. So Art 634 is the venue, and they're located at 634 Mechanic Street in Jackson. Now, they are making this venue available to us, and it was on your recommendation that I talked to them. And so it has that historical significance connection with the prison because it was part of the, what, the manufacturing wing of the prison? Is that essentially what it was, the workshop for the wagon company?
Yes.
Wow. Yeah.
And very, you know, as I said, popular and so forth. And there's another, if I can, little story that attaches this building, the old prison, to Art 634. And that is that the way the guards could get to their towers when the old prison was functioning was through underground tunnels.
Okay, wow.
Now, the tunnels, you know, people, as soon as they'd hear that, when I'm doing the tours, they would ask, oh, but tunnels, wouldn't that be an easy way for, you know, a prisoner to escape? Well, the tunnels were 3.5 to 4 feet high. So to walk in them, you'd have to, you know, bend way over. So you couldn't run. Mm-hmm. And each tunnel ultimately led to a guard's tower.
Oh.
So they were not a wise means of an attempted escape. But these tunnels went all the way under what is now the parking lot for Armory Arts Village, the old prison, and they went into and under the Jackson Wagon Factory, which had guards stationed, you know, around. I mean, all of the workers there were inmates from the prison.
Wow.
So we are, this old prison building is still attached in a way to the old Jackson Wagon Company, now Art 634, via the tunnels. And stories go that there are kids who tried you know, they like shimmy down between the boards on the steps at Art 634 leading to its porch. So they wanted to see the tunnels.
Yeah.
And a lot of parents were missing their children. And they had to be rescued
these
tunnels.
So are the tunnels still there, or are they filled in?
Yes.
Or? Okay.
They're on the prison grounds, that it's grown over.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, some dirt has fallen in. They're not operable.
Okay.
And, you know, you wouldn't want to get into them because you'd have to be rescued.
Wow.
So.
Wow. Quite an amazing history of that place. Yeah. So I'm kind of looking forward to this event. It's April 6th in Jackson, Michigan. And
let me tell you something. They had another event that they wanted me to be at. It kind of showed some of the art that's still being done here at Armory Arts, and that's being done at Art 634 and around town. And writing authorship is considered obviously an art. So they asked me to set up a table. I've also written another book that came out this past year. It's called The Town That Shot Itself in the Foot.
Right. We mentioned that the last time we talked. Yeah. So, and sales been going well on that one as well, huh?
Yeah. So when Art 634 asked me to participate in that general arts event, I'm just telling you this and the other authors who are going to be there, I did not have a minute break.
Wow.
The people were so, they came to my table, they bought both books, they wanted to know, they had questions galore. It was a really wonderful group, and I'm sure the new owners of 634 are doing really interesting programs and stuff, so I'm sure we'll have a good turnout for sure.
Yeah, there's already a lot of people responding to it on Facebook that they want to go. So, and I'll put the links to that, folks, in the show note descriptions of this episode so that you could just go on Facebook and reserve and say that you want to come. But all the information will be there. It's on a Saturday, April 6th, Saturday, and it's going to be from 2 to 4. And once again, the address is 634 North Mechanic Street in Jackson. And the venue is Art 634. And just from the historical perspective, this building is going to be interesting to spend some time at. And Judy and I are going to be there talking about our books, as well as Tobin and Tom Carr. And so we're going to have some different stories from different areas of Michigan. And hopefully we'll be able to repeat this event next year and have even more Michigan true crime authors attend next year and have...
Well, that would be great.
That'd be just really. make it a regular event, you know, and just have a bunch of us... have it become a growing event where you have more and more authors showing up, you know, so.
Yeah, it certainly is a perfect venue, you know, for that. So, and the building itself, just going in there, the main room that we would be in was the very first, the West Wing, the very first cell block in the state of Michigan.
Wow.
And the bars are still on the windows. And it went later, it was taken over by the military and turned into an armory. They had to put lighting in because the old prison didn't have electricity. Wow. And the lights that hang from the ceiling are the wheels. They were, you know, light bulbs put in, but the wheels from the cannons in the Civil War.
Really? So they made the fixtures out of those wheels?
Right.
Wow.
So there's, I mean, it's just such an interesting building, and I'll be happy to answer questions about it too.
Oh, I hope that you will talk about it. That would be great, and maybe you can spin some of the ghost stories that you mentioned in the book.
Which
by the way, we'll probably have to do a whole different episode on that. I'll have to have you back on maybe in October, and we'll do a ghost stories at the prison episode. Because there's some interesting tales that you've included in the book. But if you want to read about those folks, you can get her book. It's called Jacktown. And I'll put the link where you can purchase the copy. Do you have a website, Judy, that I should share?
Judy Gail Krasno. It's my whole name.
Okay.
.org.
Okay, good.
So, and I think if you put in Judy Gail, the Krasno pops up.
Okay.
And yes, I have that. And also my book is available from the History Press and Arcadia, which work together,
right,
and on Amazon.
Okay, great.
So,
I'll put some links in the show notes so people can find it easily. It's a wonderful book. I love how you put so many different collections of stories within the pages of that book, and it's a fascinating read. And I think everybody digging into that rich little history that's just happened right there in Jackson, that it's going to be, they're going to enjoy it. So, and they can get a copy in person if they come out to the Michigan True Crime Symposium.
Right, on April 6th.
Exactly.
2 to 4.
Great. Well, it's been a pleasure having you on. Been a pleasure having you back on again, Judy. It's always great to talk to you.
Well, thank you so much for doing so. I, as you can tell, I really enjoy talking about this. It's one of my major passions. So,
yeah.
Well, yeah,
I'm looking forward to hanging out with you in April. That's going to be a lot of fun. Maybe you can give me a sneak tour of the prison or something. That'd be fun, too.
Okay, I will do that. And I think probably the people, I got so busy with the writing and other facets of that I turned the actual tours over to Steve Rudolph and Jim Guerrero.
Oh, okay.
And they'll probably be offering, some tours that day. And they're two delightful people who also are very enthusiastic about the history. So
great.
And they learned it from me.
Yeah. Well, good. So, should be a lot of fun. Should be a lot of fun. I hope everybody will come on out to that program, and I'm looking forward to seeing the building. So it's going to be an exciting day. So
very good. Well, thanks a million, and I'll be seeing you certainly on the 6th.
Okay. Well, I've been speaking with Judy Gail Krasnow. She's the author of the history book called Jacktown: History and Hard Times at Michigan's First State Prison. And it's been wonderful talking to her, telling us some stories of the old prison in Jackson, Michigan. If you would like to reach out to me, you can find me at michaeldelaware.com. I'm always happy to hear from my listeners. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please be sure to leave a rating or review on whatever app that you are listening on. And check out the links in the show notes, because I'll give you the links where you can get a copy of Judy's book, as well as information about the Michigan True Crime Symposium and my website as well. And until next time, when we take another journey into yesterday and explore even more fascinating tales from Southwest Michigan's past, thank you for listening.